We're going to do a forced start here because we've got a lot of material we still got to get through. So I'm not very good about finding a place just to kind of stop. So we're going to push the boundaries a little bit of time. And in the earlier break, Sister Tracy had a really good thing that she showed me. And I hope that I remember it. When we get to the subject of religion, I hope I can remember it. So telling myself now so that I remember later. Memory is not my strong suit. Now, as we went over this, we see here clearly, this is quite the contrast in how God views education. The scriptures themselves are not about individualization or self-realization, but conformity to the will of God. As Brother Sammy talked about last night, it's God manifestation, with eternal benefits at stake. Now, what benefits does humanism have to offer? It has nothing. It has nothing to offer except for the now. Now, public education doesn't stop with these things. And it's not just public. It is in private education. We were discussing during the break. It's everywhere. Maybe sometimes even worse in the private education because they've got a little more freedom to move forward a little faster. It pushes feminism, sexual permissiveness, and experimentation through sex education courses, encouraging gender confusion at a very impressionable age, pushing it on children. You know, well, you could, you know, it's you could, you know, maybe you can be a woman eventually if you're born a boy, or maybe you can, you know, you go. It's insanity, madness. And of course, there is the gay agenda. And the homosexual movement loves education. They love it. And children. They love children. Which is forcing changed gender roles, two mommies or two daddies, into what is taught or even casually referenced at the elementary levels. References to a family consisting of a mother and father are considered to be discriminatory. And don't forget environmentalism, which is forced on kids with a religious fervor. With kids knowing more about recycling and drowning polar bears, really, knowing more about recycling and drowning polar bears than they do about reading and writing. Or knowing more about non-existent dinosaurs than where their milk or food comes from. We were personally chastised by a sixth grader a couple of years ago when we threw away a piece of paper into the wastebasket and not the recycling bin. Of course, I told him that we'd just grow more trees, but I was a little concerned about where that was going to end up. Luckily, I got away with that one. This is my school. We're actually considered to be a green school. In order to get the funding to do... It's a pretty nice facility. In order to get the funding to do it, part of it was, a federal or state grant that would be an environmentally friendly school. Part of that was also the strong pushing of an environmental standard or environmental curriculum. That's luckily has kind of fallen by the wayside just because we don't have time to do it. But that flag on the very right-hand side, when we have visitors to the school, they always ask me, you know, what is that other flag up there? Well, actually, that's the environmentalist flag. I'm not so sure that even half of our students know what that flag represents. But I just find it very irritating every time I walk into that room. It is very disturbing when we hear Christadelphians put a great deal of emphasis or take pride in the success of their children in school or go to great lengths to push higher education in the pursuit of career. Parents naturally want their children to do well, and we do not condone slothfulness. But how important is it for our young people to achieve in the ways of the world and in these kinds of environments? Educational achievement should not be looked on as a status symbol, as it is only a prolonged exposure and absorbing of the ways of a godless world, which has a conditioning and numbing effect on us as to how bad the world really is. Are Christadelphian parents satisfied with a child who makes a living as a carpenter, a fisherman, or a tent maker? Now, hopefully you perceive the point that we're making with that. We expose ourselves to the education systems of this world by what is necessary, not what ambition dictates. But public education and universities are not the only means of educating the mind. Multimedia through television, radio, internet, video games are tools of the humanist education. And it is idolatry as well. How else has the principles of promiscuity, covetousness through advertising and marketing, the lack of respect towards elders to the glorification of the youth culture, and the gay agenda, as well as all other humanistic, liberal-minded agendas found such a captive? How else have they found such a captive and willing audience, which has incrementally changed an entire culture by making such things entertaining? But there is a true education that is vitally important, and that is a matter of life and death. Critical thinking and reason is important. Not that everything is questioned and necessarily rejected, but so that everything is tested and accepted or rejected as it can be proven in the Scriptures. So that we, as adults, may grow up to believe it, because we truly know it, understand it, and can defend it, not because we have been told to believe it. Such is not an intelligent faith and is not acceptable to God, as is very similar to the blind acceptance of humanism by the masses. But at the same time, the instruction in the fear and admonition of the Lord is absolutely necessary so that a young person has the necessary tools, information, and examples in which to make an informed and faith-based decision. This cannot be left to the whims and shallow logic of a child or young person, but must be under the guidance of experience and intelligence. Christ was able to reason with the doctors of the law in the temple at the age of 12. No doubt enabled with superior intellect, we admit that, but nonetheless, he had to have been taught and was therefore able to intelligently reason. The law of Moses was referenced in the third chapter of Galatians as a schoolmaster to bring the Israelites unto Christ. We put special emphasis here. It was a excuse me. It was a very specific, overreaching system of education that was not only a way of belief or thinking, but a way of life. We read in Deuteronomy 6:5. Please turn to Deuteronomy 6:5. Deuteronomy 6:5. Right after the hero Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. Shema Israel. It states, "And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might, and these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the post of thy house and on thy gates." And why? Why is this? We see an answer in Psalm 78, verses 7 and 8. Psalm 78, 7 and 8. "That they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments, and might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, and whose spirit was not steadfast with God." The previous verse, verse 6, is actually the one that I was wanting to go for, even though the whole context is important. "That the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare to them their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the work of God, but keep His commandments." Now, do we comprehend the intensity and diligence of the command as found in Deuteronomy? A command that Christ himself confirmed in the gospel accounts. The impact of Sunday morning Sunday schools and yearly Bible schools and gatherings are lost in the noise when the rest of the time is almost nonstop exposure to the world. Quickly going through a few passages here. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 7. Have them up here, do we not? Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get understanding. And then Proverbs 23:23. Buy the truth and sell it not, also wisdom and instruction and understanding. 2 Timothy. All Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine. 2 Timothy 3. All Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness. In Ephesians 6:4. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Now, discipline is a part of this. Discipline is a part of education, a very key segment of education. The Proverbs are full of the admonition of correction with the rod, which is the very, very much part of the education process. Not done out of anger or retribution, as the Scriptures are quite plain about in condemning abuse, but out of love for the good of the child. God works with His sons and daughters the same way, through chastisement and correction. As we're told in Hebrews, "For whom the Lord loveth, He chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom He receiveth." But the humanist, through their warped sense of human psychology, have rejected such discipline as it being viewed as physical abuse or emotionally harmful to self-esteem. We are taught to use in education what they call love and logic, to reason with the child. Love him, reason with the child, and then therefore they'll do the right thing. It's again another humanist term. This is done to manipulate behavior. And this is a position that many parents in the world have taken. But in education, we are seeing terrible consequences for this, which go beyond behavior. But how children are able to think and reason, they can't. They can't. No sense of responsibility and no sense of shame. They have no sense of shame. It's terrible. Now, it is not for us to say whether or not believers should allow their children to attend public school or if they should be homeschooled, though you know some of the things that we see up there are pretty powerful. Not all public schools are as humanistic as we have described, but the culture is changing very fast, even in the most socially conservative of strongholds. We have never viewed Christian schools as an option, never. For what should be other obvious reasons? One thing is for certain. We do need to be prepared to function in this world, to be in it, but not of it. Whether in the public or home, our young people should be prepared. We as adults should be prepared to discern and understand humanism in all its forms and anything that is in conflict, even at the most subtle level, with God's commands, principles, and precepts. And parents should never be too busy to be engaged or naive themselves. Neither do we voluntarily put ourselves in positions that expose us to the humanistic thinking and activities of this world. To do such is simply spiritual suicide. Humanism and religion. Some of you have maybe seen these bumper stickers on vehicles. The first one's pretty common. Coexist, which they take the different religious and not even religious symbols. There's the peace symbol up there. Gender is up there. Put it together. Can't we just all coexist? If as long as we're doing good for our fellow man, we should just be able to get along. Of course, there's the Muslim symbol there. They're not really into that. They don't see the world that way. The second one, tolerance. There's an Indian peace pipe up there. Some of the same symbology used. Science at the very end. E equals MC squared. Tolerance. Believe in it. And then live in peace and harmony. I remember the first time I saw the first. I've not seen the other two. I found those online. The first one I see all over the place. blew me away. But the scriptures have quite a different idea about this coexisting of different ideas and religions. Of course, Jeremiah 16:19, the Gentiles shall come unto thee from the ends of the earth and shall say, surely our fathers have inherited lies, vanity, and things wherein there is no profit. And then Zephaniah 3:9, I will turn to the people a pure language or a pure doctrine, that they may all call upon the name of Yahweh to serve Him with one consent. Not many ideas getting along with each other. One consent. The same thing that is commanded of the Christ Ecclesia today. Humanism or religion? So what does religion, namely Christianity so-called, and even Christadelphia, have to do with a philosophy that by definition is opposed to God and religion? Much more than may be thought or even perceived. Again, we will state that humanism has reached into every aspect of the culture we live in all of its institutions, and is reflected in the phrases we use, our language, in our thought process of how right and wrong is perceived, or is to or not to be dealt with, and to the very core of how we view the world, our worldview. We may even still understand evil as a concept, but have a humanistic view in regard to the larger picture. Someone may still recognize the evil of murder, abortion, or theft. But when it comes to the concept that we are to be separate from the world, we'll have a very broad tolerance to how that should be applied. They may feel that they need to be nice to everyone, to a rejection of the notion that Bible truth is a very narrow and specific belief system that requires very specific intolerances and exclusiveness. To one infected with humanistic thinking, the idea of being dogmatic on scriptural beliefs and principles, and to reject any who do not believe or conduct themselves according to those principles, is viewed as incompatible with other scriptural principles of doing good to all men, or to love thy neighbor as thyself. Or for those who want to enjoy the social fellowship or positive message of love and being loved, that's critical. A positive message of love and feeling that they are loved, and a sense of acceptance and belonging that they might find with religion, while at the same time not wanting anyone telling them what they should or should not do in their lives. So, as we mentioned earlier, if one can take appealing aspects of humanism, looking out for the general welfare of all men, no moral absolutes, liberty, equality, brotherhood, and combine it with the appealing aspects of religion, a God that loves you, judge not, love your neighbor as thyself, etc., if you can combine what is appealing to the flesh of what are actually mutually exclusive concepts if viewed correctly, then you have something that can be labeled as Christian or religious humanism. The Methodists have a catchphrase that they often post in the front of their churches, and I know Brother Adam pointed to me several years ago. It was posted out at the Methodist church here in Damascus. The phrase, open hearts, open doors, open minds. It is the principle of tolerance. It doesn't matter what you believe. It doesn't matter what you do. Just come and love and be loved. Sounds nice, but it will not save anyone. And this is essentially what it amounts to in what we call ecumenicalism. Worldwide unity among Christians that goes further to include all religions. And of course, coexist. Now, interestingly enough, the Catholic system was the first victim of the frog-like spirits that came out of the French Revolution. Liberty, equality, and fraternity was the enemy of the church. And therefore, the Catholics lost all temporal power. It lost prestige, and it lost influence. But in the true form for a harlot, the Catholic system has been able to adapt to the times and regain a great deal of influence and prestige in the process using humanism. And this has always been the characteristic of the Catholic system, to adopt to the many ups and downs that it has experienced for the sake of its survival. In recent years, it became a champion of humanist ideals and the so-called rights of man. A few quotes again. This was from a news clipping in July 2009 that we came across, which states, blending a call for increased aid to developing nations, support for global governance, which is very much part of the humanist agenda too, with real teeth, alarm at the unregulated exploitation of the environment, and staunch opposition to population control programs, Pope Benedict today sketched what he called a Christian humanism for the globalized age. Now, from the current Pope Francis, and why we had his picture up at the very beginning. He says, if one has the answers to all the questions, that is the proof that God is not with him. It means that he is a false prophet. Interesting that the Pope would accuse others of being a false prophet. That he is a false prophet using religion for himself. The great leaders of the people of God, like Moses, have always left room for doubt. You must leave room for the Lord, not for our certainties. We must be humble. Well, certainly we must be humble. But that has nothing to do with being certain about what we believe. I think Moses was pretty certain about what he believed. Another one. Truth, according to the Christian faith, is God's love for us in Jesus Christ. Therefore, truth is a relationship. The humanists love the concept of relationships. So is that what that's what truth is? Truth is a relationship. That's what we've brought it down to. Each of us has a vision of good and of evil. We have to encourage people to move towards what they think is good. Everyone has his own idea of good and evil and must choose to follow the good and fight evil as he conceives them. That would be enough to make the world a better place. So you fight good and evil as you conceive them. No absolutes. And finally, and many of you are probably familiar when he said this, if someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and he has goodwill, who am I to judge? We shouldn't marginalize people for this. They must be integrated into society. If you have goodwill, you're a good person. I hate to go off on a tangent here. I hate to admit it. When I get home, I usually get home around 5 o'clock in the evening and we'll turn on the 5 o'clock news. And right before that is the Ellen, I can never say her name, DeGeneres, or some say degenerate, her TV show. And I find it remarkable is that at the end of her show, she always says, be kind to one another. Be kind to one another. And people eat it up. They see this person who lives a very amoral life, a very degenerate life, but is nice to people, gives money to people, has good causes and all these things, and people cannot, it very much blurs their vision as to what true righteousness is all about. It strikes me every, you know, I try to time it just right so that I get to the top of the news, and one blends to the other, and that pops up. The news has its own problems, so maybe time to stop watching the news. So again, there is much more that could be supplied here. I mean, we're not even scratching the surface. But the Catholic embracing of humanism, which has been embraced by the Protestant movement as well, is not a matter of a secret but open declaration. For them, it is clear that beliefs don't matter as long as you are a good person with good intentions. And what constitutes a good person is one who embraces the humanistic mindset. Out of the 60s and 70s came a very vocal group of Jesuits, especially out of South America, keep that in mind, who began very outspokenly to promote the ideals of liberty, fraternity, and equality as a theological position and not merely as a matter of politics. Where does the current Pope come from? He's South American. Yes, he was a part of this movement. At first, this was a serious problem for the Catholic Church. But we have seen the humanistic philosophy take over the leadership roles within Catholicism. Please note that the current Pope is from South America and was very much a force among the Jesuits in regard to the cry of human rights during his days as a priest. An English Jesuit, his name was Martin de Arcy, active in the 1930s through 50s, stated in his book, Humanism and Christianity, "We are all Christ's creatures. Even the simplest peasant has learned this, and with it had developed a sense of freedom and personal rights long before the Renaissance. He was protected by common law and in the church. In the sight of God, he knew himself to be equal of peers, princes, and popes. Such a knowledge led on to the late realization embodied in the cry of liberty, fraternity, and equality." So here's an English Jesuit basically trying to have the Catholic Church take credit for the spirit of humanism. Rather ironic. In the 1970s, there was a series of meetings between leading humanists and Vatican officials in an attempt to come to an understanding with the two sides and to forge an alliance. Several interesting things were said, but we just have a couple of examples here. Brussels, October 1970. A Jesuit priest, Gomez, and I'm not going to say his last name, stated, "Among the many types of humanism that I have met in human history, I have found that of Jesus of Nazareth, particularly attractive, although remote in time and open to completion by many more recent cultural elements, it is a humanism of universal, unselfish, brotherly love." So, Jesus is a humanist. And then, at the end of the meetings, a noted humanist stated, "After several hours of discussion on the first day, we looked at one another with some amusement and observed the Catholics sound like humanists and the humanists sound like Catholics." So, why the change among Catholic leadership? Again, this is about influence and power, and the church will not lose that. They desire relevance. They are willing to bring all beliefs and backgrounds under their umbrella as long as they can continue to drive the agenda. The horrid atrocities committed by the Catholics against believers and Jews throughout its history is the furthest thing from showing concern towards freedom of belief or goodwill towards men in the slightest bit. Now, Protestants have actually led the way in the rush towards humanism. The embracing of homosexuality by majority democratic vote, like the Anglican Church, and the women and gay priests, feminism, political activism, etc., there is found a rejection of Bible teaching for the promotion of general welfare and life coaching. The churches have become psychological support groups with little to no emphasis or regard for the matter of salvation, false or otherwise. Sister Tracy had shared with me a video of Joel Osteen and his wife, I guess it just came out this week, of her up there saying, we do good for our fellow man, but we don't do it because we're serving God. We do it because we're serving ourselves. We should do it to serve ourselves. One of the most prominent preachers in the country right now. Their emphasis is upon the youth activities, music, missionary trips in foreign countries for building homes, feeding the poor, medical services, but no emphasis upon salvation and certainly not of the coming kingdom. It is for the good and pleasing of their fellow man without understanding what can truly benefit them, Bible truth. All these things are fine for the world in the sense of alleviating a little present suffering. But again, They miss the true mercy that can be given to others. The emphasis is upon love thy neighbor in a temporal sense and going to the far reaches of the globe to prove that love. Now, getting back to the growing tolerances and embracing of homosexuality in the churches, we came across an interesting comment. This is from the Methodist. They published a report in 1980 called the Revised Report on Human Sexuality, which attempted to evade the unambiguous teachings of Old and New Testament scriptures by saying, the words we have in our Bible cannot be directly equated with the words of God. This is a so-called religious organization. And the report eventually concluded that the quality of homosexual attraction is thus to be assessed by the same basic criteria which are applied to heterosexual relationships. They're the same thing. This all fits into the principle of moral relativism, as promoted by Aristotle. The churches argue that the values of first century Christians and of the Israelites before them were relative values. It is argued that as something becomes culturally acceptable, it becomes morally acceptable. This is moral and theological relativism, that truth and its application changes with time. And remember the manifestation of humanism in education, that there are no absolute truths. Now, before leaving the subject of humanism in the churches, we wish to briefly address the melding of Darwinism and religion. This only makes sense in that if the principles of humanism are embraced, truly embraced, the acceptance of evolutionary theory is not far behind. Keep that a note as we transition into Christadelphia. As Bible teaching has long been apostatized by Orthodox Christianity, their appreciation for biblical authority is already on shaky ground. Throw humanism into the mix, and the rest falls like a house of cards. In 1950, Pope Pius XII declared that there, and I quote, and I don't have it up here on the front, he said, there's no intrinsic conflict between Christianity and evolution. Allowance was made for the theory that man had evolved from apes, but that God was behind the process. The church openly rejects intelligent design and young earth creationism, saying that it, and I quote, pretends to be science. This is from Pope Pius XII. In 1993, in reference to what was declared back in 1950, John Paul II endorsed the theory of evolution and stated that evolution is, and I quote, an essential subject which deeply interests the church, end of quote, and went further to state that the Big Bang theory proves the existence of God. So they're trying to meld the two in between. It is standardized practice in America for Catholic schools to teach evolution in their science curriculum. And there is a medallion in the floor of Notre Dame, in Indiana, that states, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. Now, as a religious institution, why would it not say nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of a creator? Now, brethren and young people, either we believe the creation account as it is stated in the book of Genesis, including the formation of Adam and Eve out of the dust of the ground, or we do not. There is no in-between. You cannot reconcile those two. Though God is the author of all that we might deem as science, no one can reconcile the cornerstone of humanistic theory, which is evolution, with divine revelation of the creation account. Though, and realize that it has arrived, the promotion of evolution is taking place within Christadelphia today. It's coming. It's here. And you're going to start hearing about it. Evolution theology, I believe, is what they call it. Something to that extent. Now, humanism and Christadelphians. So we have spent some time merely scratching the surface in regard to humanism in the churches. And we apologize for, we got pretty fast there in talking. We were hoping to make sure that we fit everything in. Maybe slow down and stop stuttering a little bit too. So why should we pay any heed to the churches? Why should we care? Well, we really don't care about the churches. We understand their role and their place, and we don't have a care for that. But because we see many parallels taking shape amongst believers that mirror what we see taking place in the mainstream churches. And this is what concerns us the most. As when speaking of the household, there tends to be a sense of safety and trust that hides very real dangers. The symptoms of humanism tend not to be as extreme and ugly as is found fully manifest within the world. Among believers, it is much more subtle and has the appearance of kindness and love. Though it does not overly reject God, of course it doesn't, and claims just the opposite for itself, it in fact does reject Him by perverting His ways. The very same thing the apostles contended with the Gnostics, the knowing ones. It must be understood that the truth itself propounds black and white principles. The truth itself propounds black and white principles, not shades of a gray, as some leaders in our community have propounded in recent years, what I have been personally told. There are no gray areas. And any confusion on our part is not a deficiency in the clarity of God's Word, but in our own understanding. There may be things that we don't understand, but there are no gray areas. God's Word and His plan and His commandments contained therein is a system of revealed absolutes. And it is our responsibility to understand and conform to those absolutes. Now, one of the areas that has been an opening for the humanistic spirit is the application of democratic principles in the operation of the ecclesias. In the ninth chapter of McAllister's book on democracy that we held up earlier, he devotes most of the chapter to quotations from Brother Roberts and Brother Thomas on the matter of ecclesial organization and leadership. In the formation of the booklet known as the Ecclesial Guide, which we're all familiar with, knowing that we lived in a time absent of direct divine appointments through the ministration of the Holy Spirit, as in the days of the first century ecclesia, Brother Roberts begrudgingly laid out a system of ecclesial governance by consent, or in other words, the appointment of brethren and ecclesial decisions by majority vote. Now, this is in the Ecclesial Guide. He admitted that such an admission is doubtless a concession to the evil principle of democracy, but there is no other practical alternative that may work out beneficial if subordinated to the commandments of Christ, which are all prevailing with true disciples. So basically what Brother Roberts is stating is this isn't a good system to start with, but it is the best that we can do during this time. And it can only work if the commandments of Christ are submitted to. Let me emphasize that. It can only work if the commandments of Christ in all applications. I'm not talking about that list that's in the back of our statement of faith. I'm talking about a complete picture in regard to the commandments of Christ. It can only work if that is submitted to. Now, I apologize for referencing a person of the world, but I think it gives us some interesting insight into how democracy was also viewed by others. John Adams, the second president of the United States, and one of the so-called founding fathers, essentially made the same observation about the American system of democracy. This is what he says. First of all, he said, remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There is never a democracy that did not commit suicide. And added to this, he says, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. But that is what one is to expect from the institutions of men, is it not, when we're talking about democracy? But as we have seen with the moral and civil collapse within this country, so too do we see with the doctrinal and moral apathies and collapse, general worldliness, and humanism within the brotherhood. And I know that these principles can be viewed as negative. We're not trying to be negative. We're trying to state facts. We are talking about facts. And we have to face up to those. The democratic ecclesial model worked tolerably well as long as brethren were subordinate to the commandments of Christ and were united in the same mind and judgment according to the old paths of the truth. But it also left an opening for a spirit of liberty and equality. And as values changed in the world, so too did they change in the brotherhood. And therefore, the demonic nature of the frog-like spirits have manifested themselves in the brotherhood. The will of the majority vote, or of the arranging brethren that they elected, would not necessarily reflect the will of God and of Christ. This also leads to the will or desires of the young people, what the young people want, driving the agenda, and of the sisters equaling, if not trumping, the guidance of elder brothers. Later in his life, Brother Roberts regretted his suggestions as articulated in the Ecclesial Guide. And in 1897, he stated, our present system was disapproved of by Dr. Thomas, who thought we ought to aim at a nearer conformity to the apostolic system of perpetual elders with authority. He was afraid the constant appeal for the ecclesia's sanction by vote would open the door for turbulent spirits and put in their power to interfere with ecclesial peace. I erred from too great confidence in human nature on the side of too great conformity to the republican spirit of the age. Experience has proved Dr. Thomas right in this matter, and my own views at the beginning crude and unsuitable. Now, we will note, though, that even the apostolic model of perpetual elders and the presence of the Holy Spirit itself was not able to fend off the ecclesia from the humanistic, Gnostic, and Judaizing elements that corrupted it from within. We believe that brethren that have preceded us in the modern revival of the truth, by and large, have done the best that they could in making sure that our ecclesial system was arranged according to decency and order. But nonetheless, our experiment with democracy has given an opening for the humanistic spirit to make shipwreck of the faith in these last days, as the will of the majority is playing out with disastrous results. This system, with individual ecclesias working and determining their own course of action, but voluntarily united with other ecclesias upon the same shared principles, has been a far cry better than the centralized authoritarian power and administration that characterized the hierarchical priesthood system of the Catholic Church and Protestant denominations. But we cringe when we hear brethren state that the democratic system of ecclesial administration comes from the Scriptures, when in fact it does not come from the Scriptures. Let us be very clear on that point. Now, as our time is very limited, we will briefly touch upon a few other areas of critical concern and threat, which we believe are sources that embody the spirit of humanism within the household. You might be thinking, well, there goes Aaron Thomas again. Well, yes, here I go again. First of all, the cry of liberty within the household as a free exercise of conscience. We have read it articulated within Christadelphia that we have, and I quote, we have the right to express ourselves, end of quote. This was part of a lengthy argument put forward by the Thought for the Week series on the WCF blog back in 2012. We also have this freedom of expression played out on almost a daily basis on the various Christadelphian social media circles, where any idea seems as good as another. But we ask, where is the right sanctioned in the Scriptures? There is a growing attitude that new ideas have a right to be expressed and discussed and reasonably considered and tolerated, no matter how much we may disagree. This was the approach of the Greeks, who spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing, with no solid conclusions ever reached. To oppose such and to reject such is considered by the humanist spirit as hate and unchristlike, unloving. But if the truth is known and understood, why should anything that is opposed to the truth be given any consideration? If we know the truth, why would we give any consideration to ideas that compromise, undermine, or openly reject that truth? The truth is not an open forum. 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 15 through 18. Very, very important verse in this regard. 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 15 through 18. I don't think that's what I want. It was a good one too. Very good passage. First Peter chapter 2. I'm gonna have to come back to that. I'm sorry about that passage, but that was a very good passage to look up. I had in mind with this idea of this right to express ourselves. Go ahead. 2 Peter. I did, but that's not the one I want. Yeah, they're good passages, but they're not exactly what I want. Thank you. And when I get up here and I get nervous, my mind has gone away from me to try to quote it off my top of my head. Nonetheless, but if the truth is known and understood, why should anything that is opposed to the truth be given any consideration? Again, the truth is not an open forum. Actually, what I wanted is 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 15 through 18. Whew, glad I remembered that. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 15 through 18. Study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. And please note his words here. But shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase unto more ungodliness. Don't throw it out there as an open forum. Shun it. Reject it. If the principles of truth, as long contended for, are not satisfactory, then association with other communities should be pursued. Being Christadelphian once represented a specific set of doctrinal beliefs and practices. If one does not agree with such principles or practices, then it is best for them to identify their religious beliefs by another name and associate with another group. Where was Christ's tolerance when he rebuked Peter by saying, "Get me behind me, Satan," when Peter opposed the reality of his coming crucifixion? How many other scriptures can be reviewed that show clear and decisive action against error? Not an entertaining of it. Too many for us to review at this time. But what do the scriptures command in regard to the leaven of false doctrine and practice? A cutting off of that leaven. Along with this view, that the ways of our earlier brethren 50 or 100 years ago were outdated, too harsh for our times, but suited for the culture that they lived in. Now, brethren and young people, consider the gross fallacy of such a thought. This is the humanistic philosophy of moral relativism. It is a cover for bringing in new beliefs and new ways more palatable to our modern humanistic taste. If this is logically viewed, consider our brethren the apostles who lived 2,000 years ago. How outdated are their ways, which is completely removed from our times and experience. The principles of truth do not change ever. The principles of truth, whether in belief or practice, do not change ever. Go to Hebrews chapter 13, verses 8 and 9. Makes me think of the Jesuit priest idea that that Christ was not a complete product in his first appearance as far as his character was concerned. 13, 8, and 9. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday and today and forever. And be not carried away about with diverse and strange doctrines. For it is a good thing that the heart be established with grace, not with meats, which have not profited them that have been occupied therein. Now, also, the rise of professional-type, centralized organizations that concern themselves with supporting the ecclesias through the use of worldly, educated, and trained brethren. In other words, Gnostics or knowing ones. Also, for outreach and preaching and missionary efforts, so-called, charitable efforts, etc. Adopting, if not attempting, to compete with the ways of the business world and the churches. Groups such as the Williamsburg Christadelphian Foundation and Whitefields Project, the Caring Network, keep your eyes on the next one, the Meal a Day Fund, keep your eyes on that one. Christadelphian Bible Mission, Prepare to Preach, Christadelphian Youth Circle, softball charities, blood drives, and others. Brother Thomas stated it best in the fourth volume of Eureka when he wrote, I quote, "Let it be remembered that successful meetings have been built up not by inter-ecclesial leagues or big sensational efforts or expensive advertisements, but by the quiet, plodding toil of brethren and sisters laboring in their own localities." There are a lot of serious problems on many different levels with these types of organizations in the Brotherhood and efforts operating as they continue to operate. And concerned brethren should be pointing out who these organizations are, how they operate, and why, this is the biggest one, why they are wrong. Not just ignoring them, which includes the false doctrines they promote, their humanistic adoption of worldly psychological approaches in regard to emphasizing relationships, and that manipulate emotions, especially of the young people, in what we call the Oprah Winfrey approach. The salary positions given to their leaders and their missionaries, their efforts in going to the far reaches of the globe to supposedly teach the gospel, a watered-down, if not perverted, version, and to glory in their efforts, and they do glory in their efforts, to feed and house the poor, which is part of the humanistic approach to make the world a better place, and much more. But how can we be so cruel and hateful to criticize such things? Number one, because such de-emphasize and undermine the doctrine of the coming kingdom, the truth in general, by their emphasis upon improving life now, as well as the false doctrines they put forward. Please note this. Early Christadelphians were not involved with the philanthropy of the world they lived in. They also did not involve themselves with distant missionary efforts across the globe, as was being practiced by the churches. Brother Williams even declares such in his report to the U.S. Census regarding the Christadelphians in the early 1900s, that we do not do missionary efforts. Early brethren understood that the greatest mercy we can provide is a witness to life-saving doctrine of the gospel message, and that such can be carried out within our own localities. Using others' money to go to Africa or South America certainly looks more impressive, is more dramatic, and garners more attention than being a quiet witness to friends and neighbors. We very much sense the pressures there are these days to do outreach like the churches do, to appear as caring for the plight of the downtrodden as they seem to be. But this is not what we are called to do. The pull is very strong, and to criticize such efforts can give the appearance of being unloving, uncaring in the eyes of others. We do these things when they come to our attention. We work in our immediate sphere of influence, but our primary goal is as a lightstand for life-saving, eternal truth. In this sense, all those outside of the covenants of promise are poor and naked. We do not have to, nor should we go, to the far reaches of the earth to help after the spirit of humanism. It is all fine for the world and giving the world some sense of civility, but there is only one solution for this world's troubles. Yes, we are commanded to do good unto all men, especially those of the household of faith. That's in Galatians 6:10. We should care and should be willing to help those that cross our paths that need our help. But we do not have to go out searching for it just to make ourselves feel good or to look socially responsible in the eyes of our peers. And we certainly do not need and should not rely on church-like charitable organizations to do it for us. Yes, Christ healed, and he fed the poor, and he had compassion. I love finding that word compassion in reference to Christ throughout the Scriptures, on those he came in contact with. But the preaching of the kingdom was the main objective, and his miracles and acts of compassion were signs, lessons of the moral, critical problems of spiritual corruption and of sin and death. Christ could have fed everyone. He had the power to do it. He could have healed everyone. And that is what the people wanted. But he did not, as that was not the objective of his ministry. As Christ was the furthest thing from being a humanist, and we have to always keep that in view. Neither should we make, and we are wrapping up, neither should we make affinity with the many charitable organizations or social causes in the world. And there are many, and it is quite the fad, which should raise a red flag for us in the first place. Good causes, sometimes, as far as the world goes, but we are to be separate from the world. And again, there is only one true cause, one greater good worth our time and effort. In one of the last WCF Thought for the Week, it's been suspended for, you can still see it on the WCF website, but he's moved on to other things. It was stated, if I can get it to come up, he said this. He said, several years ago when I was in South Africa, we traveled early one morning to a very poor settlement where the men gathered each morning by the side of the road to offer themselves as day laborers. We set up a barbecue to cook sausages for these very poor and hungry men. As we were in the midst of our cooking, a priest came out from a local church and informed us that we were trespassing on his church's property. We explained that we were doing and apologized, having no idea that we were on his property. He told us to hold on and came back after about 10 minutes with a big pot of tea. We finished the morning working side by side, feeding these hungry men. I wonder what would have happened if the shoe were on the other foot. If we came one morning to our ecclesial hall and found a priest on the front lawn cooking for the poor, how would we respond? Would we go get a pot of coffee and work side by side or run them off? These people love hypotheticals to kind of mix things up. We don't see other Christians as partners. And he's bemoaning this if you see the larger context. He says, we don't see other Christians as partners, but as competitors. Too often we use condescending terms in reference to other Christians, if not often openly hostile terms. Yes, we do, and we should. They are the enemy. Now, so does the joint effort of doing good unto all men now trump all other considerations, including criticism of the falsehood that the churches preach that nullifies life-saving truth? This same writer also states, and I quote, "We have much we can learn from the churches," end of quote. We have personally heard and argued with those that make this very same statement. Christadelphians. And that is exactly the problem we have in our hands. Now, very quickly, we have those that call themselves mended Christadelphians, of the Christadelphians or the Christadelphians for Unity group. As their website states, we are a mended community doing unity. Such a group like the Unity 208 Agreement Group ignore the differences of fundamental doctrine between the amended and unamended, and in a spirit of ecumenicalism, worldwide brotherhood, join hand in hand in a spirit of misled love, cooperation, and unscriptural practices of fellowship. Doctrinal absolutes are either glossed over or ignored altogether just so that teachers can be shared, young people can find someone to marry, and a wider scope for friendship enjoyed. This is their reasons, not mine. There is the One Voice movement that many of us are familiar with, where it is promoted that sisters should be equals with brothers in regard to the speaking, teaching duties, and leadership of the ecclesia. And remembering that at the heart of humanism is evolutionary Darwinian theory, so too do we have those calling themselves Christadelphians promoting the principles of evolution and denying the literal nature of the creation account as found in the first chapters of Genesis, even teaching at some so-called unamended Bible schools. Evolutionists within the Brotherhood, the spirit of humanism. Oops, jumped ahead. I'll just keep it there. We also have the gay Christadelphians, which we all have run into on the internet. And it's only a matter of time, based upon the growing spirit of moral relativism, judge not, and tolerances, that it becomes widely accepted among Christadelphians, barring Christ's soon return. The humanistic culture that is also making allowance for evolutionary theory is in place within Christadelphia for its general acceptance. Have no doubt about it. It's already making all kinds of allowances, doctrinal and otherwise. And we have the general and growing apathies and tolerances where doctrinal and applicational error is viewed as something to be tolerated for the sake of preserving social unity and family ties within the Christadelphian organization, with the organization and goodwill being viewed more important than the upholding of doctrinal truth and scriptural fellowship. It is this general spirit that will assure the success of the humanistic spirits that we have just listed. Now, as we conclude our thoughts, and we appreciate your patience with some added time here, we must say that the amount of information that we had to condense into three classes is massive, absolutely massive. We did not cover all that should be covered when considering this subject, nor did we provide all scriptural passages and arguments that could have been provided. But what we hope, especially in regard to you, the young people, that a better understanding of what exactly humanism is might be comprehended so that you might pursue further investigation and perceive it as you and we all are exposed to it on a continual basis. All of us are infected with the humanist spirit in one way or another. And we have to be able and willing to see outside of ourselves and inside of ourselves to identify it. With that, we quote from the closing remarks of, there's actually a Christadelphian book entitled Humanism, the Subtle Delusion. There's some things in the book that I'm a little hesitant to fully recommend it, but it does have some good thoughts. And I'll state this, and I quote, "We should not, therefore, spend our time reading man's wisdom, considering his scientific theories, becoming brainwashed with his thoughts, wondering if we ought perhaps to vote for his human improvement schemes, or staring fascinated at his wonderful inventions. Those who gain the victory over the beast have quite a different attitude, and they sing." And this is from Revelation 15:3. "Great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. Who shall not fear thee, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy. For all nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest. And again, thank you for your time.